Madame André. Chaudaigu Plateau, Cantal, France, May 1944. In many ways, it feels as though I am starting over once Gaspar and his men arrive at Chaudaigu. I have Fournier's men trained. They know better than to leer or whistle. It's been months since I looked over my shoulder on my daily trip to the creek. But no sooner do the Maquisards from Montmouchet arrive than I am set back. It is unacceptable, untenable, and I've put my knife to three different Adam's apples since breakfast. The particular middle-aged Frenchman whom I have pressed up against a tree finds me much less attractive than he did 30 seconds ago, now that I have the pointy end of one knife positioned against his jugular and the sharp edge of another ready to slice off his testicles. There's nothing like the fear of castration to eliminate a man's sexual ardor. Je ne suis pas une pute, comprenez-vous? The fool is holding his breath, and he'll likely pass out before I've had the chance to finish what I am saying. I need him to understand me. It is very important that he and his friends learn this lesson quickly. I can't spend my days defending myself from harassment. Nod if you understand. He's afraid to move his head, but he shifts it up and down slightly. I drop both knives and step away. Good. Now go tell your friends exactly what I just told you. But first, repeat it to me. He clears his throat.
You are not a whore.
And you will not treat me like one. Go, now. He scuttles into the forest, and I wait until he's gone before turning to the shadows where Hubert has been standing for the last few moments. This is never going to work, I tell him. No, it isn't. Do you know who that man is?
I don't remember his name, but he belongs to Gaspar. He was one of the first to retreat from Montmouchet. He arrived 3 days ago, smelled of dried piss and cheap brandy, he says.
He doesn't smell any better now.
I roll my neck from left to right. I slept wrong, and there's a kink at the base of my skull that's making it painful to look up.
Do you know which group he's been assigned to?
Judex's.
Excellent. I'd planned to start with him anyway.
Hubert is one of those men who can ask questions without speaking. He can simply look at you and tip his chin, or flare one nostril. On more than one occasion, he's made no expression whatsoever, and I know exactly what he's asking anyway. Ours is a platonic marriage, in which we have learned to read each other like a primer. I have to visit each of Gaspar's groups, I say, and I may as well start at the top. These men reflect their leaders, and my best chance of being taken seriously is for word to get out, from the top, that I'm not to be trifled with.
I think neutering him would have done that nicely, he says.
Yes, well, I still have to meet with Judex. Better to start off on the right foot.
Do you mean to say that you are going to meet with him by yourself?
Of course not. You're coming with me.
I pat Hubert on the chest as I pass him.
Gaspar has his lieutenant, and I have mine.
Saint Martial, Cantal, France, May 20th, 1944. The village of Saint Martial is only 5 kilometers from our encampment atop the Chaudaigu Plateau. Recently abandoned by its inhabitants due to German troop movements in the area, it gives Gaspar a place to reconvene with his troops, and has the added benefit of getting them out of my immediate presence. I sent the middle-aged bugger who accosted me in the forest yesterday on ahead with a message that I will be visiting Gaspar today to meet with him and Judex. What he does not know is that I had Hubert take me to 3 of his groups this morning to assess the troops. I asked them what weapons they have and about those they lost after leaving Montmouchet. I asked about uniforms, or the lack thereof, and transportation. What they have eaten all these long months, and where they acquire it. I asked what they think of their leaders and their fellow men-in-arms. So by the time Hubert rounds the last bend on the narrow, pitted lane between Chaudaigu and Saint Martial, I know a great deal more about Gaspar, his men, and their needs than he imagines I do. True to form, Gaspar has avoided camping in the woods. As soon as he heard about the availability of housing in Saint Martial, he directed his lieutenants to take up residence,
Neither Hubert nor I bothered to point out that the German Luftwaffe regularly strafes farms and villages. The residents of Saint Martial would still be in their homes otherwise. The village itself is composed of no more than 15 small stone buildings scattered across the hilltop, above a large reservoir with a single dirt road that leads in and out. As soon as we pull into the village, Gaspar's men spring from the hedgerow wielding rifles that I know are unloaded. I roll down my window and say, "Madame André, Gaspar is expecting me." We are directed to the largest building in the village, and Gaspar stands in the doorway, arms crossed. I am perversely happy to see that the lack of chateau makes him appear less intimidating. The house makes the man, I suppose. Gaspar leads us through the door. "Please," he says, once Hubert and I are inside. "Won't you join Judex and me for a drink?" "Of course." To the Marquis, the ability to outdrink an opponent is proof of one's manhood. To refuse Gaspar would be to undo all the progress we've made these last few days. Besides, I know what game he's playing, and I intend to win. Henri trained me well. Once seated around an old scuffed kitchen table with a glass of brandy in my hand, I tell Gaspar, "I can offer you and each of your men 35 francs a day. That should nicely accommodate your needs for food and basic supplies." "Non," Gaspar says, shaking a thick finger in my face. "I know for a fact that Fournier and his men receive 45. "What I give to them is none of your concern." "Come, Madame André, you must be equitable." I look around the small, tidy kitchen. "Is it equitable that you have lodgings and he does not?" "This village has been here empty for months. He could have taken possession any time he liked." I hide my smile with a sip of brandy. I believe he likes to maintain the high ground. Comfort is less important to Fournier than security. If that hits the mark, Gaspar does a remarkable job of not letting it show. However, I can see Judex grip his glass a little tighter. "These men are not the same," he mutters, then swallows a large mouthful of brandy. 35 francs a day. Boots, revolvers, and ammunition. That is where we will begin." Gaspar's brandy isn't the worst I've had, but it clearly hasn't been long in the bottle, and there's a trail of heat at the back of my throat. It's strong. Too strong to take as quickly as they are. "But your men are obviously of strong fighting caliber. They'd have to be to fend off the Germans the way they did. You killed 10 men for every one you lost. That's impressive." "Big men and small boys are much the same. They need female validation." And I don't regret saying this to Gaspar. It's not an empty compliment. He and his men fought ferociously. I can respect that. And I don't mind tossing him that bone if it will help bring him into line. Gaspar nods, pleased with the compliment, and pours each of us another finger of brandy. I lift my glass and gaze at the warm amber liquid. I think of Henri and his drinking rules. Then I take off my jacket and place it on the back of the chair. I take a sip, smile. 35 francs, boots, weapons, ammunition. And tomorrow, I will place an order for the explosives you'll need to destroy the railway that services the German garrison near Le Puy. It's what I've planned to give him all along, but Gaspar thinks I've made a concession. He congratulates himself by tipping a bit more brandy into my glass. "Drink up," he insists. I lift my glass and raise it toward Hubert. "Cheers." He clinks his glass to mine and squints. God love Hubert. The man could spot a cue at 50 paces. Hubert reaches inside his jacket and pulls out the map Fournier has given us. "Now we must discuss our plans for retreat in the event of attack," he says.
"There's no need," Judex says. "Together, our numbers are strong. We can fight off the Germans easily."
"That's what you thought once before," I say. "And our numbers together are just over 7,000, one-third of what the Germans have. We will not take chances, and we will be prepared."
Hubert turns the map and pushes it across the table to face Gaspar and Judex.
Here, here, and here, he says, tapping the map, are the lines of retreat that we have established.
But those are rivers.
Judex blinks heavily. The brandy is already getting to him.
And you have us going through the deepest sections. That is insanity.
You might be surprised how possible they can be. Fournier has spent a great deal of time working out this route, Hubert says.
I raise my glass once more and roll the amber liquid over my tongue. I let the heat ground me as it slides down the back of my throat.
You may have been the king of Montmouchet, but Fournier knows this area and you will have to trust that the rivers are the safest means of retreat.
No matter,
Judex says, and I detect the faintest slur at the edge of his words.
We won't need to retreat.
There is less than a finger of brandy left in Gaspar's glass, and he tips it into his mouth. He holds it there for several seconds, and then I see his Adam's apple bob as he swallows.
Now let us discuss the weapons. I want to be there during the airdrop.
No, I say.
I have the right.
No, I say again. You do not.
I could come anyway.
You tried that once, I say. I would hope you've not forgotten how that ended.
Judex looks back and forth between us curiously, and I realize that he doesn't know what we're talking about. Interesting. The tip of Gaspar's nose is red, but I can't tell whether it's caused by anger or brandy. He lifts the bottle and tips it toward me in question. I nod. He pours me another finger, then two more for himself.
Hubert, I notice, swirls the brandy around his glass and continually lifts it to his mouth, but there is little change in the level of alcohol. He's doing an excellent job of making it look as though he's drinking, however, because Gaspar tips a bit more into his glass without paying attention to how much is there already.
If you'll excuse me, I say, I need the loo. This was Henri's fourth lesson, learned many months after that first dinner with his father. Excuse yourself, use the bathroom, and if at all possible, get some fresh air.
Outhouse, Judex says, pointing toward the kitchen door.
Hubert takes his cue and repositions the map in the middle of the table. He taps six different areas marked in red.
Here are the known German positions, he says.
Gaspar and Judex lean over the map, and neither of them notices me take my glass with me. I push through the kitchen door and out into the night air. The outhouse is located several hundred feet away, but I take a moment to assess myself. I can feel the pleasant tingle of a buzz, but nothing more. A guard stands on either side of the door, and I smile at each of them in turn.
Follow me to that outhouse and I'll cut your throats.
Once inside the stone privy, I hold my breath, pour the rest of my brandy down the hole, and relieve myself. On the way back to the house, I find what I'm looking for. The water pump is almost hidden in a clump of weeds beside the garden gate. But it works, and the water is clean and cold. I drink an entire glass before heading back inside. The brandy bottle is almost empty now, but Gaspar does not hesitate to offer me more. I accept, noting that Judex can hardly sit upright any longer. My guess is that he will be the first to fall. And I'm not wrong. It's not that he goes out of his chair a few minutes later, but rather that he sinks slowly to the table, chin resting on his forearm. His eyes are glassy, the tip of his nose is red, and the corners of his mouth are turned down. His bluster has turned to melancholy, and the effect is one of being deflated. I wouldn't have taken him for a sad drunk. Not the thing you'd expect from a man who could ruthlessly torture his enemy with a red-hot poker. When I finish off my brandy half an hour later, Gaspar concedes defeat.
You are not at all drunk, he tells me.
No, I am not.
I did try.
I knew you would.
But did you know, Madame André, that you are a brass-plated bitch?
Somehow, coming from Gaspar in this moment, it does not sound like an insult. In fact,
This may be the closest he ever comes to paying me a compliment.
I do. And I would very much appreciate it if you would communicate that to your men.
They'll leave you alone from now on.
Good.
I will send word when your shipment has arrived, and I will be present when it's delivered.
Why?
Because you must sign receipts, I say.
He doesn't say goodbye or walk us to the door. He simply watches us leave with a newfound interest. It is after 1 in the morning, but the stars are so numerous and so bright that Hubert and I can see each other's face plainly as we walk to the car. Hubert slides behind the wheel of the Renault and gives me the most curious gaze.
How the flaming hell did you do that? He asks.
Do what?
Drink like that. I've never seen anything like it. You knocked back twice as much brandy as Judex, and he's passed out on the table while you're as chipper as a bluebird.
More like a pigeon.
My point is, you're the last man standing.
Woman?
Good grief, you know what I mean, Nance. Just shut up for a second. I can't figure out where it all went, much less how you're even conscious. It's like you have a hollow leg.
He throws his hands up in exasperation, then starts the car and puts it in reverse.
That is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen.
I had a very good teacher. I lean my head back against the seat, pleasantly tired and happy with this part of the night's work. Gaspar got what he wanted, weapons and supplies for his men, and I got what I wanted, dominance. I yawn as Hubert pulls the Renault onto the dirt track to drive us the short distance back to our encampment.
Pity we can't go to sleep.
Why not?
We've got to help Fournier with tonight's shipment.
And this marks the first time I have ever heard Hubert well and properly curse. Chaudet du Plateau, Cantal, France, June 5th, 1944. Special message for Hélène. Anselm delivered to Montluçon this AM. Collect immediately. I take the message from Dennis Rake, read it, then shake it in his face. What the hell am I supposed to do with this? He sits across from me in the bus.
Well, apparently, ducky, you are to drive your scrawny ass.
I am not scrawny.
You are, actually. You've lost at least a stone since being here, but that's beside the point. You are to go collect Anselm.
And how am I supposed to know where he is?
He shakes his head, exasperated.
Can't you read? He's in Montluçon.
And Montluçon is Maurice Southgate's area. He was supposed to meet us at the drop zone, remember?
Oh no, that's right. You were off cavorting in Bourges with your lover.
I was not.
He sticks a finger in my face.
In Bourges.
Despite much prodding, Dennis has kept the name and location of his lover a secret. And for good reason. Both men would likely be shot on sight if they were discovered together.
My point is that Maurice Southgate was supposed to give me the address and the password for his contact in Montluçon the night we landed, but I was met by Tardivar instead. Without that information, it will be nearly impossible to collect Anselm.
Dennis props his feet up on the stump, leans his head against the back of his seat, and thinks for a moment.
Don't you have a name for this contact?
Madame Renard, and I know that she was once the housekeeper of an ambassador in Paris. Also that she makes excellent cakes, but this does me little good when I don't even know where to begin looking for her.
That's not entirely true. Just head to Mont,
he says, and then ducks out the door quickly to avoid the boot I've thrown at his head.
Luçon, I know, I say, to find a woman who might live anywhere, and having found her, persuade her to give up Anselm without a password.
Easy enough, sure.
No matter that I'd shoot anyone who tried to pull a stunt like that on me.
I think of Gaspar and what he did to Roger. And Roger had the correct password. I drop my head to my hands, shake it. I've been given a direct order, and I can't very well leave one of Britain's best weapons instructors unattended in the middle of territory thick with Germans. I have no choice.
Damn it, I say as I dig beneath a seat for my pack. Time to go find a needle in a haystack.
Fournier gives me his best car and Jacques, one of his lieutenants, to drive.
I'd thought of going alone, but Hubert rejected the idea out of hand. We know the brown shirts are looking for the white mouse. We know that they have connected said mouse to Madame André. He argues they will be less suspicious of a married couple than of a woman driving alone through occupied territory. The fact that we are driving at all is problematic. Access to a vehicle immediately identifies us as either resistance or German, and depending on who controls each checkpoint along the way, could mean the patrols shoot first and ask questions later. I'd take one of Fournier's bicycles, but it's a long trip, and Anselm won't fit on the back. I have no other choice than to go with Jacques and pretend to be his wife should we be apprehended. Jacques wisely does not crack a smile at this arrangement. In fact, he does not smile at all. He seems to be the sort of man whose lips were sewn together at birth. He is silent as we load the car with grenades and a Sten gun in case we come across German patrol. Then I strap a bicycle to the roof. It will be less conspicuous to ride around on that once we reach Montluçon. We are about to be off when someone calls for me.
Madame André!
I turn to see Louis jog across the clearing. He raises his bandaged hand in greeting. You look less green around the gills, I tell him. Did you find a doctor in Chaudeg?
Oui.
He clears his throat.
I hear you are going to Montluçon.
Word travels fast, I see.
That is where I lived, before the war. My wife is there still. She is pregnant.
I'm not sure whether to congratulate him or offer my condolences. I pity anyone bringing a child into the world right now.
Would you deliver something to her for me?
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out an envelope stuffed with francs. An address is scribbled across the front.
My wages. I've saved them all for her.
What are you eating then?
He shrugs.
Enough. Louis's thin frame would suggest otherwise, so I pull a lump of bills from the envelope and hand them back to him. Yes, I'll take this to your wife, but you must keep yourself fed in the meantime.
Thank you, Madame André. Her name is Simone Autry.
Jacques has the most curious expression on his face when I climb into the car. What? I ask.
Careful,
Jacques says, with a slight twitch of his jaw, struggling to control his staggered consonants.
Or you'll end up being postmaster as well.
I look at him, fascinated. He stutters. No wonder the man hasn't spoken a single word since our arrival 3 months ago. He is looking at me now, one eye pinched tight in expectation of ridicule. But he has trusted me with this secret, and I refuse to shame him. Jacques, I say, did you just crack a joke?
Course not.
His stoic face belies nothing as he starts the engine and puts the car in drive, but I think I catch the hint of a smile when he turns away. Before long, I am grateful for his presence. The whole area is crawling with brown shirts. There are patrols and roadblocks everywhere, and we are forced to take back roads and send friendly scouts ahead when we can find them. Montluçon is only 2 hours from Fournier's encampment, but we stop at every farm and village along the way to inquire about German patrols. He stays in the car, while I knock at doors and ask about troop movements nearby. I pass along a few francs with each handshake and explain that we are trying to go north, unmolested by brown shirts.
Just down there, one villager says, pointing to a main crossroads. They've set up an ambush behind the curve.
Merci beaucoup,
I say, and we're off again, skirting around town through an alley and across a field to avoid being detected. It goes on and on like this for hours as we creep toward Montluçon. Sometimes it's not the Germans who give us trouble, however.
They have gone, one woman tells us, but the Maquis will stop you. I will come with you and tell them that you are of the Maquis d'Auvergne. I taught half of those boys in school. They will listen to me.
With local chaperones, we proceed slowly,
never once having to make use of the Sten gun hidden under the floorboard at my feet. It is early evening when we reach Montluçon, and I have Jacques stop the car a quarter of a mile from the address Louis gave me. I take the bike down while he scouts a position to watch the car. If the car draws unwanted attention, come and warn me, I say. Jacques nods, then slips into the hedgerow to keep watch. I cycle into town and look for the house number. Few people bother to lift their heads as I pass. The cottage is small and tidy. There are flowers in the window boxes, and the front step has been swept. I am always a little startled to find my countrymen maintaining any kind of normalcy in the face of war. I respect it. It is one of a thousand courageous ways of thumbing your nose at the enemy. A quick breath, then I tuck my hair behind my ears, trying to look as presentable as possible. I knock on the door. It is answered by an older woman who appears to be blind in one eye. This cannot be Louis's wife. Madame Autry? I ask, my voice laced with hesitance. No. Her hair is like silver feathers drifting in the breeze, and I'm momentarily distracted by its ethereal beauty. Who are you? She asks. A friend of Louis's. I've come with a message for Simone. Okay, then, she says, and turns over her shoulder. Simone, you have a visitor. A young, pretty woman with auburn hair comes to the door. She looks rather like a toothpick that has swallowed an olive. Heavens, you poor dear! I've never seen anyone as pregnant as you. The words are out of my mouth before I can stop them, and I could kick myself. The last thing I need is to offend her. But much to my relief, the girl laughs.
I feel as though I will be the only woman in the history of the world to be pregnant forever.
She wipes one hand on her apron and offers it to me.
Simone.
André. I shake her hand, then motion to a little bench sitting beside the house. Come, I have a message from your husband.
Louis
is perfectly fine and unharmed. No point mentioning the fingers. It's only a tiny lie, so I don't even wince. I saw him this morning. Simone waddles to the bench and lowers her body onto it. She groans and lifts her swollen feet, rolling her ankles, before setting them back on the ground. I hand her the envelope. From your husband, for you and the baby. He sends his love. Simone peeks into the envelope, gasps, then presses it to her chest. She juts out her chin and blinks hard, trying not to cry.
We did not think he would be paid.
He has earned every penny. I sit for a moment and answer all her questions. How is he? What has he been doing? Does he have enough to eat? Are his spirits up? Finally, I set my hand on her forearm and get to my point. Before I go, there is one thing you can help me with, I tell her.
Anything.
I am looking for a Madame Renard. Do you know of her? Simone shakes her head, and her hair swings at her shoulders. It looks like brass in the fading sun, and I am envious of the color, the way it catches the light and tosses it back against her skin.
No. What does she look like?
I shrug. I only know that she lives on the outskirts of town, that she makes marvelous cakes, and that she used to work for an ambassador.
An ambassador? I have a friend who told me once that her neighbor used to work in Paris for the French ambassador to Sweden.
Where does your friend live? Simone gives me the address, with instructions to tell her friend that she sent me, and once more I am pedaling off on this most ridiculous goose chase. The house in question is two streets over, and twice as well kept as that of Simone and her parents. There isn't a dead leaf or cobweb to be seen anywhere in the yard or on the exterior of the home. But the porch light is on, and the door is opened by a woman Simone's exact opposite, nearly as wide as she is tall, and twice as old.
Bonjour, madame. Pardon the intrusion. Simone Autry sent me.
I am feeling less inclined to believe this expedition will result in anything at all, so I skip the formalities and get right to the point. I am looking for a Madame Renard. Simone said you have a friend who once worked for an ambassador in Paris? The woman, I do not even bother to ask her name at this point, has very small eyes in her very round face. It gives her the most strangely cheerful expression I've ever seen, like a cookie that smiles back right before you eat it.
Do you mean Alice?
I wager a guess.
Alice Renard? Yes.
Then yes, that is exactly who I'm looking for, and I do not mean to be rude, but time is of the essence. She points to a larger home at the end of the street.
Tell her that Ines sent you.
For the dozenth time today, I am shouting, "Merci beaucoup," over my shoulder. Then I am pedaling once again. I catch my breath in this yard, looking back the way I've come, trying to mentally retrace my route. I've been in such a rush to get here that it's possible I might get lost and not be able to find my way back to Jacques. He, meanwhile, has no idea that I've gone on from Louis's wife. I straighten my hair, dust off my slacks, and wipe a bead of perspiration from my forehead. I knock 3 times. There is no answer. But the lights are on, and I see the curtains twitch in my peripheral vision. I knock again. Nothing. I am debating whether to call out to her and if that will do any good. I decide against it and lift my hand once more, but the door pulls inward before I can try again. Before me stands a distinguished-looking woman with thin lips and a red checkered apron. There is a smudge of flour on the end of her nose.
Madame Renard?
She nods but says nothing.
My name is André. You do not know me, but I know of you.
I want to add that Maurice Southgate sent me, but if my suspicions are true and he is dead, she might know this already, and I could end up with a bullet between my eyes. So I take a riskier tack.
I believe you have a packet for me?
Alice Renard draws herself up straighter, like a measuring tape pulled taut, and I see that she is several inches taller than me. She stands on her doorstep, very still and very quiet. I have come too far and gone to such trouble, and the thought of leaving without Anselm when I might be only feet away from him is intolerable. So I break my own rules.
You do not have to believe me. I wouldn't if I were you, to be honest. But I've just come from the home of your friend Ines, and before that a friend of hers. Both of them pointed me in the direction of the only woman they knew who once worked in the home of an ambassador.
I pause long enough to take a breath. And that is when I smell it. Baking. The heavy, sweet, unmistakable scent of Baba Ahum. I lean forward, close my eyes, and inhale. My mouth waters.
I have heard so much about your cakes.
This is better than any password. She smiles then, and it transforms her face. She glances over my shoulder, no doubt to make sure I have not been followed.
I have been cooking for a guest. Please come in.
Madame Renard steps aside, lets me into her home, then shuts the door. She leads me into the kitchen, where the smell of rum cake permeates the air so heavily I can almost taste it.
You can come out now,
Madame Renard says, as though to no one in particular. It occurs to me, a moment too late, that this is how special operatives die. They wander like idiots into traps. They don't ask enough questions. They follow friendly directions and end up behind closed doors at the mercy of strangers. All these thoughts are colliding as the door of an enormous armoire swings open and a man steps out. His mouth is drawn tight, and a .45 caliber revolver is in his hand and pointed directly at my face.
Nancy Fiocca. Marseille, July 18th, 1940. I head to the Hôtel de l'Évêque, but instead of going in the front entrance on the Canebière,
I circle to the side and enter through a back door on the Cour Belsunce. Within weeks of the armistice, Marseille was flooded by Gestapo thinly disguised as the German Commission. All of them dress in mufti, civilian clothes, but they fool no one. They're just so damn German. Blonde and blue-eyed, with those clean-shaven square jaws, the guttural words. They ooze arrogance, not even bothering to speak French, ordering the staff around like servants. They've taken up residence in many of the popular hotels, hogging the bars and scaring the locals. This particular group of German secret police, seven in total, has claimed the elaborate foyer of the Hôtel de l'UVP as their watering hole. I avoid them whenever I come to visit Antoine. I've not seen my husband in 4.5 months. I am worried. I am lonely. But mostly I detest eating dinner by myself. So most evenings I find my way to Antoine's and enjoy an aperitif or two until dinner, which I eat at the bar. Sometimes I bring a novel to read, mostly Victor Hugo, since I am working my way through Henri's collection. But I am often depressed by the tender romance I find on those pages. So there are many nights that I sit here and talk to Antoine, listen to the radio or to the conversations of others. We seem to have developed a new rapport since my trip to Cannes, and his company makes me feel less alone. "How did you get that limp?" I ask Antoine when he shuffles toward me with a glass of brandy in hand. I've wondered for years, and it occurs to me that I may as well ask. He sets the glass down in front of me, then gives me the most curious glance. "Did you know that you are the only person who has ever asked me that question outright?" "What about Henri?" "No. He stares sometimes, so I tell him stories of being wounded during the Great War, or," he offers a guilty smile, "other things not fit for a lady's ear, but not because he asks." "And what answer will you give me?" "The truth, if that's what you like." "Please." "I was kicked in the thigh by a mule 15 years ago. It snapped my femur in half." He touches his leg to show me where. "The doctors tried to set it, but," he shrugs, "I am not young, and it healed poorly. My options were limited, so I left the family vineyard in Corsica and came here to tend bar. I'm good with people. I know wine. It made sense at the time, and now I am too old for a career change." There is nothing outrageous about the story, nothing grandiose. I am inclined to believe him. It's the sort of random injury that turns a man's life upside down. And it's not that I am grateful Antoine was injured, but I am certainly glad that he is here in this place now. I wink at him. "Your secret is safe with me." "You are collecting my secrets at an astonishing rate, madame." Antoine limps off. And that is when I see the two men sitting at the other end of the bar. One of them is reading a Joseph Conrad novel, and the other is staring at me. Both of them have a general sense of unease about them. I let my gaze float past them, pretending a casual survey of the bar, then focus once more on my brandy. I did not think my trip to Cannes would catch up with me so quickly. After a few minutes, I give Antoine a quick glance. He holds my gaze for a moment to let me know he's seen the request, then polishes several glasses and straightens a few bottles on the shelf before making his way back toward me. "About that envelope that I delivered to Cannes." "Yes?" "Does anyone know it passed through here?" "Françoise, my contact in Toulouse. Why?" "Because that man at the end of the bar with the red hair is the one who collected it at the Hotel Martinez." Antoine doesn't turn to look, but the muscle along his jaw does tense. "Why do I get the impression you won't be satisfied to just sit and wonder what he's doing here?" "Because they're in my bar actually, and I don't like the idea that I could have been followed. So I may as well get to the bottom of it. Henri will kill me if I let you go anywhere near those men," he hisses. Henri, as you well know, has run off to be a hero. What he doesn't know won't upset him. Besides, I have no intention of going over there. I flash him a wicked grin. I mean to make them come to me. And what good will that do? It will help me understand what they're doing in Marseille. For the second time in as many weeks, I hold out my hand and ask for a menu. As always, Antoine's radio is on, tuned to some big band playing swing music. We have been speaking in low voices and in French, so there is little chance the strangers at the end of the bar can follow our conversation. Still, Antoine does as I ask. He reaches under the bar, pulls out a menu, and hands it to me. Merci, I say, then pretend to look it over. I've committed to playing this part, so I go all in. After a moment, I shake my head, then say in an exasperated voice, in English, "What I wouldn't give for a plate of bangers and mash." I am gratified to find that my gut instincts are still in good working order, because both men at the end of the bar sit up straighter and twist their heads to look at me. It takes a great effort not to laugh, because the sudden movement makes them appear rather like American prairie dogs. I can see them confer out of the corner of my eye. Both nod, and then make their way toward me. The redhead reaches me first. "Excuse me," he says, also in English, "but we couldn't help overhearing you just now. Are you British?" Now that he's standing beside me, I can see that my guess about him being part of the Commonwealth was spot on. He's a Scotsman through and through. Tall, broad-shouldered, although thin at the moment, charming and friendly. Until I met Henri, he would have been the embodiment of my very favourite species of man. "Not quite," I say with a grin. I do love being right. "Australian." "That counts." He plops down on the stool to my right, relieved. Antoine does not speak English, so I know he can't follow the conversation, but he is watching me. And once he sees that I'm not alarmed by their arrival, he reaches toward the radio and turns it up another notch to protect us from being overheard by the men in the lobby.
"We thought you were French at first," says the second man.
His accent is harder to place. Lots of French, a hint of German, and something else, something with a bit of zing to it. He has a high, broad forehead with a receding hairline, dark, wavy hair, warm brown eyes. I like his nose as well. It is strong and straight and provides him an excellent profile. "Only by marriage." I hold up my left hand to show them the thin gold band on my ring finger. And then I make a decision based on instinct alone. "Please have a seat. Join me for dinner. It's always nice to meet another subject of the crown."
"Ian Garrow."
The Scottish redhead extends his hand. "Is that your name?" I ask. A pause, a triumphant grin, and then, "I thought you went by Simon Bolivar." He is so genuinely startled that I laugh out loud.
"How?" I was curious to see who would collect the envelope, so I waited in the bar, I tell him.
Then I take the hand that is still outstretched before me. "Nancy Fiocca." They don't know me, but they know Françoise. I don't know Françoise, but I know Antoine. I trust him and he trusts her, so it is not a huge stretch for any of us to trust one another, at least enough to sit and have dinner. I can tell they are thinking the same thing. These two men look at each other, assessing, and I see them make a silent decision. It's there in the slant of their mouths, the way their shoulders relax, the faint nod. They choose to put their caution aside.
"This is my friend, Patrick O'Leary," Garrow says.
I turn to the man on my left. "O'Leary is an Irish name."
"Yes."
"You are not Irish."
"No,"
he says with a wink.
"What are you then?"
"Cautious," he says. But he does so with a smile, and I think that I might like him in the end. What are you doing in Marseille? I ask, looking from one to the other. There is a loud burst of laughter from the lobby where the Germans are gathered. Garrow looks over his shoulder and thinks for a moment.
In order to explain that to you, madam, we will need to go somewhere a great deal more private.
We run a network of safe houses between here and Spain, Patrick O'Leary says. We are on our way to Perpignan with four Jewish refugees, and thanks to the papers you delivered to Cannes, they should be able to get into Spain with minimal trouble.
Belgian. It comes to me suddenly. He's Belgian. That zing in O'Leary's accent is a touch of Flemish, and when combined with the French and German, it makes up the typical Belgian accent. He clearly doesn't want me to know this, however, so I keep the revelation to myself. All I have to go on is my gut. Trust is always an act of faith, and I listen as Garrow and O'Leary explain how they have begun the process of establishing an escape route for captured soldiers and persecuted Jews. They tell me that there are over 200 British soldiers interred in Marseille's Fort Saint-Jean alone. But none of that convinces me of their trustworthiness. It is the fact that they sit in my living room drinking my liquor while my dogs lie curled up in each of their laps, asleep. I have always believed Picon and Grenadine to be excellent judges of character. They would never allow me to fall in with a pack of traitors.
You work with Françoise? I ask once they have divulged the basics of their operation.
If he's surprised that I know this name, he doesn't let on.
She is the last stop on our route, O'Leary says.
I have Henri's radio turned up one notch higher than I'd like and set to classical music so that our neighbour, Monsieur Paquet, cannot overhear our conversation. He has long been the commissioner of police, but since the armistice, I have learned that he is also loyal to the new government in Vichy and more than happy to inform on his fellow citizens.
Why have you trusted me with all of this? I ask.
Garrow scratches his chin.
My gut says that you are an ally. You delivered those papers to Cannes. You were in the bar where Françoise told us to meet her Marseille contact. At the very least, you're not working against us.
I pull my bare feet under me and lean my head against the wing of my chair. 4 years ago, I saw a brown shirt in Vienna nearly whip an old woman to death. I promised myself that day that if there was anything I could ever do to fight against the Germans, I would. So no, I'm not working against you. And if I'm being perfectly honest, delivering transit papers to a luxury hotel hardly feels like work at all. Garrow sniffs the glass in his hand. It's a single malt Scotch whiskey that I handed him within minutes of his arrival. He seems to regard it as a priceless object because he's only taken one sip, and his eyes rolled back in pleasure at that, so I have no idea what he'd do if I poured him another finger. He smells the Scotch again, closes his eyes, and whistles a few bars of Auld Lang Syne. I know they've come for something, but neither of them has gotten around to asking yet. Perhaps they feel as though they need to butter me up. Regardless, I won't know until they spit it out. I doubt that you reveal the specifics of your resistance activities to every person you meet. My guess is that you came to me for something very specific, I ask.
We need a radio,
Patrick O'Leary says bluntly. I am learning that he is the more practical and direct of the two.
So we can get information straight from the BBC and not have to filter out the lies coming from Vichy. To hear them tell it, we've already lost the war and London is the new Nazi headquarters of Europe.
Also, Garrow says, voice deadpan,
it wouldn't hurt if we could get our hands on 1,000 cigarettes.
He doesn't crack a smile as he says this, and I can't tell whether he's serious.
What on earth do you need with so many cigarettes?
Intelligence gathering, Garrow says. You would be stunned at the way people talk when you hand them a cigarette.
Do you plan on talking to 1,000 people?
Eventually. But some people take more bribing than others. It doesn't hurt to be prepared.
You seem very sure of my ability to help, I say.
You are clearly a woman of financial means.
Garrow looks around the flat.
You're the loyal wife of an upstanding French businessman. Where is he, anyway?
Somewhere in the north of France, defending the Maginot Line, or what's left of it.
He winces.
I was sorry to hear it fail.
I have to clear my throat so the words will come out properly.
So was I.
Garrow takes another sip of whiskey.
I believe you can help, because you have papers that let you move easily anywhere in the Free Zone. And by your own admission, you are a Nazi-hating, loyal subject of the Crown.
Pardon me for being blunt, Madame Fjoka, but you are exactly the kind of person we need to know right now.
I can get you a radio tomorrow and...
There is a knock at the door, and our heads swivel to the foyer. A second knock, more insistent this time, and I hold up one finger.
Wait here, I tell them.
Should we hide? O'Leary asks.
Absolutely not. This is my home. I can entertain whomever I want.
Picon trots along behind me, a low rumble in his throat. I bend down and pick him up, then whisper, "Easy, boy," in his soft little ear.
Before Henri left for the front, he installed two extra locks, a deadbolt and a chain lock, and it takes a moment to undo everything before I can swing the door open. Police Commissioner Monsieur Paquet stands on the mat. His stiff exterior belies a vicious, waspish interior. Clear eyes, straight nose, moustache, hair cropped close to his head, starched shirt.
Hello, Commissioner, how can I help you?
He tries to peer around me, his eyes narrowing into slits.
I heard voices.
So?
It's late in the evening.
I have company.
But your husband is gone.
I am allowed to entertain in his absence.
He clicks his tongue.
People might get the wrong idea.
What people, you?
Henri asked me to look out for you while he is gone.
He didn't mention that.
He wouldn't want you to know, of course.
My husband and I do not keep secrets from each other, Commissioner.
The commissioner's moustache twitches in anger.
Then he will not mind hearing that you have been entertaining strange men in his absence.
There is nothing strange about the men in my flat, and I am certain that my husband will be delighted to hear that my cousins have come to visit me. He's rather fond of them.
Cousins?
Yes, the sons of my mother's brothers. Have you no cousins of your own?
I find it difficult to believe that...
Are we really going to stand here and argue about the tangled nature of my family tree while my guests are left unattended?
Police Commissioner Monsieur Paquet glares at me.
I didn't think so. Now, have you any other business than sticking your nose in mine?
I can see the muscle along his jaw tense.
Your radio is too loud.
I will make sure to turn it down. Good night, Commissioner, I say. Then close the door in his face.
I set all three locks, lean my forehead against the door, and whisper, "Merde."
Who was that?
It is Ian Garrow behind me, his voice little more than a whisper.
The Vichy Commissioner of Police?
I don't think he likes you very much. What he likes, I say, is my flat, and he will do anything in his power to get me evicted, even if it means threatening me with noise violations and questioning my fidelity.
Garrow snorts. I've known you for 3 hours and I can already tell that you are a lot of things, but unfaithful isn't one of them.
I turn and face him. The time for pleasantries has long passed.
Why are you here? You're after more than a radio and cigarettes, right?
Garrow lifts his tumbler up to the light and peers at the last of his scotch.
The thing about you, Nancy, is that no one seems to ask questions.
I hook my thumb toward the door behind me.
Did you just get here? He asked all sorts of questions, and mark my words, he'll be back.
Garrow shakes his head.
That's different. He knows you. He knows we shouldn't be here.
Everyone else? They seem to be dazzled by you. I watched it happen tonight. That bartender, smitten.
There were 7 Nazi officers in the lobby of that hotel and you walked right out the front door. Not a single one stopped you or asked questions. They just stepped aside, let you go through, blinked a little bit in your wake.
Haha.
What?
Wake.
What do you mean?
That's my maiden name.
Ian Garrow takes the rest of his whiskey in one long swallow.
Of course it is. Of course.
He laughs. Get to the point. The point is, we need your help.
With?
Supplies. And smuggling.
I've been doing that already.
People, he says. Not just papers. But real, living, breathing people. Can you do that?
The flat I share with Henri is well over 2,000 square feet. The ceilings are 12 feet tall. The windows are floor to ceiling. Wood floor, marble countertops, brass fixtures, Persian rugs, fine china, sterling silver, crystal goblets. 2 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. The best views in all of Marseille.
I am privileged on a stupid, irrational, almost immoral level. And still, all the air escapes from these perfect, plastered rooms. It's sucked out, as though some minor deity has gasped for air. Ian Garrow wants me to smuggle human beings out of France.
Where will I take them?
To Francoise, at the Spanish border. Ian Garrow balances his empty glass on one finger, the way he might balance a broomstick or a penny. He is letting me consider his request. And there must be something wrong with me. I should be terrified, hesitant. But instead, the heightened throbbing of my pulse tells me something else. I am excited. This feels like a challenge. And much to my surprise, I am ready for it. Wait here. I tell him, then retreat to the guest bedroom. I emerge a few seconds later with 3 long rectangular boxes. I toss them to Garrow one at a time and say, I'll do it.
What's this?
He asks, fumbling the boxes as he tries to hold them in the crook of his arm.
You did ask for 1,000 cigarettes. Marseille, August 20th, 1940.
I return home at 2 in the afternoon and stand at the threshold of my flat, glaring at the door suspiciously. All my senses are still dialed up to 11, even though I safely delivered a young Jewish woman and her baby to Toulouse early this morning. The thing is, I know that I locked the door to our flat when I left yesterday. I remember turning the key counterclockwise and checking the handle. It's an old habit born of being on my own for so long. Single women in the world learn this at an early age, more so when they travel alone and live alone and come home alone every night for years and years. So I know I locked the door. But it isn't just unlocked now, it's cracked open a fraction of an inch, the way it does in the summer months when heat swells the door jamb and you don't quite pull it shut all the way. And that can mean only one of 2 things. Someone has been in our flat. Or someone is there now. There are 4 flats on each floor of our apartment building in the Cour Julien district. Each occupies 1 full corner. Henri and I live in the premier flat on the top floor, and we pay for it handsomely. I lived in the Hôtel de l'UVP for 6 months while we waited for the lease to become available. And it was an open secret that Police Commissioner Paquet tried to bribe the owners to cancel our agreement and lease the flat to him instead. I know this because Henri had to negotiate changes in our agreed rent twice before we moved in. Marseille is stunning and beautiful and picturesque, but it is also a city whose pulse beats to the rhythm of grift. This is nothing new to my husband, however, and the Fiocca name goes a long way in these negotiations. I stand right in the middle of the broad landing, glaring at Commissioner Paquet's front door. He wouldn't dare. I hiss under my breath. Fistol is working the tram. It wouldn't be fair to pull him away from his job just because I'm afraid to enter my flat. I could track down Garrow and O'Leary, but I don't dare risk Paquet seeing them here again.
We've made arrangements to meet elsewhere from now on. I listen for the sound of barking or growling, but Picon and Grenadine are silent. This worries me more than anything else. If something has happened to them. There are no footsteps. I can't hear the thump of cabinet doors being opened and closed. No scrape of wooden drawers. If I had a gun, I would pull it. If I had a knife, I would hold it. But I have no weapons and no skill to use them regardless. So I am defenseless as I wrap my fingers around the doorknob and slowly push the door open. I take one soundless step inside the flat, then another. I listen. I wait. And then I hear it. A single thump, that of something being set down on a flat wooden surface. My footsteps fall silently, one after another, as I move forward, determined to catch this thief, whoever he is, in the act. I round the corner, fists clenched, ready to scream. But my breath comes out in a whoosh instead. "Henri!" I say, stopping dead in my tracks. He's sitting in his favorite leather armchair beside the open window. The sheer curtain billows toward him in the breeze. I did not hear the dogs because they are both asleep in his lap, tongues lolling, bellies exposed, happier than they've been in months. The sun is on his face. His hair is damp from the shower. A glass of brandy is in his right hand, and his left arm is in a sling. "Who else were you expecting?" he asks.
"Henri, I have a confession to make," Nancy says, lying naked, face down in their bed. It is early evening, and the sun falls warm and golden through the window. Henri trails a finger down her spine, counting each knob, as though they are marbles set in a row, with the tip of one finger. He pauses in the hollow of her back, tracing the S-curve of her spine, back and forth, then moves on to the dimples of Venus. Never in his life has he been so obsessed with the indentation created by muscle and ligament. He rests, propped up on his right elbow, marveling at the sight before him. Nancy is furious with him for getting wounded, but he assured her countless times as they made love that it is a single bullet wound and it will heal. Honestly, he feels as though he could lift an entire car with that arm right now. Never in his life has he been so elated as when she walked into the apartment. It finally occurs to Henri that he should respond to her comment.
"I hope you mean to confess that you missed me dreadfully while I was gone."
"Well, yes."
"You don't sound very convincing."
He drops a kiss to the small of her back. "Of course I missed you."
"But I hear it in your voice. There's something else."
She buries her face in the blanket so her voice is muffled. "I didn't sit around the flat and mope while you were gone."
"I didn't think you would. But I'll have to teach you how to sin if that's the only thing you've got to confess."
He pokes her, gently, in the ribs. Nancy grunts. It's the most unladylike sound he's ever heard her make, and he has to stifle his laugh. "Oh, I've sinned," she says. Despite appearances, Henri Fiocca is a cautious man. It's how he's expanded the family fortune and kept himself out of trouble. But at these words from his wife, something at the back of his skull begins to thrum with alarm.
"What do you mean?"
"I think you know what I mean, Fiocca."
"I do not, in fact, Madame Fiocca."
They are one and the same now. She cannot distance herself any longer by using his surname. Nancy sits up and wraps the sheet around her. She crosses her legs, juts out her chin. For one terrible moment, Henri expects her to say that she has taken a lover in his absence. He suspects half the wives in Marseille have done just that over the last 5 months. It's a very French thing, the numbing of loneliness with illicit sex. But Nancy? Just the idea makes a hard knot form in the pit of his stomach. I have lied, Nancy says, straight to the faces of at least 24 Nazi officers. I have purchased items on the black market. I have transported forbidden materials, mostly fake identification and ration cards, not to mention actual humans, from one end of France to the other. I have committed treason, she whispers. Or at least that's what Vichy will say if they ever find out. And I've almost been caught in the act 3 times. Your wife is a criminal, Henri Fiocca. All the air rushes from his lungs in a grunt. His wife hasn't been sleeping with other men. Is that all? I thought you'd be furious. And I thought you were about to say you'd taken a lover. By comparison, espionage seems saintly. Henri has to move quickly in order to duck the pillow she swings at his head. Well, I haven't made my confession yet. There's more. My confession is that I have no intention of quitting now that you're home.
Ah.
I knew you'd be displeased.
I could ask you to stop.
And I would say no. We've been able to help so many people.
We?
My friends and I. You'll meet them soon.
I could demand that you stop. It is my right as your husband, Henri says, then holds up a finger the second her mouth opens. But I wouldn't do that.
I know. It's why I married you. Nancy looks at him, eyes pleading. So, what will you do? Henri sighs and climbs out of bed. He can feel the shift in her eyes, that focused attention. He is totally naked, after all, and it pleases him that all these months into their marriage, she is still distracted by the sight of him.
I will get dressed.
Why? Nancy asks as she lets her sheet fall away. It's a mercenary move meant to draw him back to bed, but Henri is determined.
Because we're going out.
Where?
To buy you a bicycle.
They leave the dogs at home. Nancy is afraid she'll wreck the bike and hurt them in the process, and he can tell that she is nervous as they walk to the nearest park. I still don't understand, she says. He pulls her tight against his side.
In France, a woman on a bicycle is invisible.
Think about it. They are everywhere. We don't even see them anymore.
But you, ma chère, are the type of woman who always gets noticed. People see you. They take note. And if I cannot stop you from doing this work, and please know that it is work that I admire, then I want you to be safe. I don't want anyone to notice you. At least with this, you can move about the city with anonymity.
She lowers her chin, gnaws at the corner of her bottom lip, and she doesn't exactly wring her hands, but they are clasped tightly in front of her as he walks the bike along the path. This is a new look for Nancy, something to be filed away in the running catalog Henri keeps of her expressions.
What's wrong? He asks.
I don't know how.
It's not hard.
Perhaps for someone who's known how since he was 8.
5.
Exactly my point.
Henri studies her. How does a woman reach adulthood and not know how to ride a bike? It's a mandatory part of childhood.
She glances away, avoiding his gaze. Not everyone grew up with wealthy parents. When you're the youngest of 6, you're lucky to have clean bathwater, much less a bicycle. It didn't exist in my world, and I never knew it should have until many years after I left home.
Henri is abashed.
Luxury is an odd thing. You don't know you have it until confronted with someone else's lack. He has always known he was wealthy. His father made sure of that, made sure it was flaunted. Every meal of his entire life has been either gourmet or damn near close. He has seen parts of the world most people only dream about. He replaces his wardrobe every 2 years. He has an expansive wine cellar. He can speak 3 languages fluently and is passable in 2 more. He is tall and handsome and has excellent teeth. He knows these things, has always been thankful for them. But a bicycle? It's such a small thing, a signpost of childhood. Never once in his life has it occurred to him that there are people in the world who didn't have one. Until now. I am sorry, he says. I didn't mean... It's not your fault. You couldn't have known. Besides, it's a stupid little thing. Just a bicycle. It's not like a yacht or a topaz or a vacation home. No, don't downplay this. Learning to ride a bike is a rite of passage. Nancy Wake. No, Henri reminds himself, Nancy Fioca is the kind of woman who conquers the world. Fearless, ferocious. Nancy is the sort of woman who bathes in a meteor shower. She is not the kind of woman who concedes to anyone. And yet, this time she surprises him. Teach me, she says. So he does.
I hate it!
Nancy howls an hour later as she wobbles down the empty path.
Who invented this seat?
I believe it's called a saddle.
Henri chuckles as he jogs along beside her.
It is a device of torture, an anvil on my bloody pelvic bone. I may as well be sitting on the edge of a sword. I swear, I damn well swear.
And she does, throwing out an impressive string of invectives.
That this was invented by a man, the same one who created that damned cotton log known as the menstrual pad. I'll kill him with my bare hands if we ever meet.
She teeters, and for one awful moment, Henri thinks she's going to end up in the brush.
If I can ever walk again.
If Henri wasn't actually afraid of her in this moment, he would laugh. But his lips twitch, and she glares at him.
I hate you, she says.
No, you don't.
I do, in fact, but we can argue about it later. I'm much too afraid of dying at the moment.
If it makes you feel any better, bicycle saddles weren't exactly created for comfort when it comes to male anatomy either. As a matter of fact, when I was 9 years old,
she gives him a withering look, and Henri decides that story is best left for another day. It's a good story, though. She'll laugh at his expense.
Go on, ma chère, he says, giving her another push down the gentle slope. Let's see you ride this thing.
And she does, for 30 feet, before her front wheel hits a rock and she starts to teeter. Nancy digs the toes of her new leather pumps, highly impractical bike wear. He did try to talk her out of them, into the gravel, ruining them completely. She grinds to a stop and whips her head around to chastise him.
You didn't fall, and you are perfectly fine, he interjects before she can get a word out. You are allowed to complain only when your knees and elbows are bloody. This is a mandatory life skill, no different than reading or writing.
I hate you,
she says again, but it's with a delighted grin. There's a light in her eyes that he hasn't seen before. Nancy presses hard on the left pedal, and she's off once more.
And I will consider it entirely your fault if my lady parts are ruined beyond repair.
But this warning is shouted over her shoulder, and Henri has to run to catch up with her.
Grenoble, France, October 1940. I step off the train and onto the platform of the Gare de Grenoble. In all the years I've lived in France, this is my first time visiting the famed medieval city. I am here to deliver one radio, currently disassembled and ensconced in my suitcase,
3 identification cards and 12 food ration cards to a woman known only as Vivienne. We are to meet in 4 hours atop the Bastille, and I will know her by the green feather tucked into the band of her red velvet cap. Every day I think things cannot become more restrictive in the free zone, and every day I am proven wrong. A week ago, the Vichy government signed into law a decree that declares all foreign-born Jews to be illegal immigrants. They are, without warning or chance of appeal, to be sent directly to Germany and housed in concentration camps. Garrow, O'Leary, and I cannot work fast enough. We cannot procure documents fast enough. When I grow tired and overwhelmed by the amount of travel before me, I remind myself that my feelings are nothing compared to those of the thousands of Jews running for their lives. There is a nip in the air, but the sky is bright and blue, and I look up to take in the perfect cloudless magnitude of it. I ground myself in the beauty of a perfect fall day. And that is why I collide with someone directly in the middle of the platform. My first instinct is to grip the handle of my suitcase even tighter. My second is to apologize. Pardon. The word catches in my mouth as I stare at the beautiful blonde in front of me. Stephanie? Her hair is mussed, her clothes are disheveled. She has been crying, and she is gripping the hand of the man beside her as though they are about to be ripped apart for all eternity. It takes Stephanie a moment longer to recognize me. I can see her pull her thoughts away from whatever problem has so deeply upset her. She focuses on my face. Her mouth forms a gentle O. And then Stephanie Marcique releases the man's hand and throws herself into my arms.
Ma petite!
It is difficult to return the hug with one arm, but I must not release my package under any circumstances. I know better. I've heard the stories of men and women caught with contraband. Rumors are spreading that the Vichy police now consider listening to the BBC a treasonous crime punishable by death. This is France under German occupation.
Nancy,
she says, then steps back. She wipes her face with her sleeve and looks at the man she's traveling with.
This is my husband, Paul. Count Gonzalez, how wonderful to finally meet you.
I expected a specimen, a man of staggering beauty. But the man who stands before me is normal. His hair is peppered with silver, his waist is a bit soft, and he's barely taller than his wife. 2 days' worth of stubble covers his jaw. His nose is crooked, and his brow is furrowed in concern. He looks over my head, scanning for something. I don't know what I have said or done wrong, but I take a step back from both of them. It takes a moment, but the Count finally extends his hand.
Pleased to meet you.
The words are French, but heavily accented in Spanish.
Nancy is an old friend of mine, Stephanie says.
And there is something in the tone of her voice that makes me wonder if she is telling him I can be trusted. He looks between us for a moment, then gently kisses her on the forehead.
Why don't you grab a coffee with your friend? I'll get our tickets.
He points to a small cafe across the street.
I'll be back in 20 minutes.
See.
Stephanie rises onto her tiptoes and plants a fierce kiss on his mouth. Then she grabs my hand and pulls me to the cafe. Stephanie insists on sitting inside in a far dim corner. A waitress arrives the moment we take our seats, but we are informed that, due to a coffee shortage, they have only tea and ersatz. I detest the roasted acorn and hickory faux coffee, but do not object when Stephanie orders us each a cup. I have never seen her like this. So rattled, so out of control.
What are you doing in Grenoble, of all places? She asks.
I set my suitcase beneath the table and I squeeze it between my knees. I open my mouth to answer, realizing at the last possible second that I cannot tell her the truth. This realization makes me suddenly, staggeringly, lonely.
I have come to meet Henri for the weekend,
I say instead. If she were halfway paying attention, she would know that I'm lying. Stephanie knows me too well. But she hasn't paid attention to my answer. Her eyes are already on the door, looking for her husband. I set my hand on hers.
Stephanie, what's wrong?
Her fragile composure crumbles. She begins to sob, and I can barely hear the answer to my question.
We have to leave France. We have to escape.
Why?
The Germans are after Paul. We are trying to get across the border into Switzerland.
This makes no sense. I shake my head. Why not Spain? Surely... Her voice drops to a whisper.
No, we can't. Not ever again. If Paul sets foot in Spain, he will be arrested for treason.
I suppose that I've always had strong instincts. I wouldn't have made it in the world as long as I did on my own if I hadn't. But since I have been working with Garrow and O'Leary, those instincts have become heightened. I can feel when a situation is wrong or dangerous. I clamp the suitcase tighter, then reach across the table and circle her wrist with the fingers of my right hand. What did he do, Steph? I don't know what to do with this new weeping version of my friend. It's a struggle not to shake her by the shoulders as I wait for answers. I am growing impatient.
He sold weapons,
she says, finally, between sobs. To who? Stephanie Marcique looks up at me. Her eyes are red, her lashes are wet, her mouth is trembling.
Everyone. Anyone who would buy them. The Spanish at first, but then the French, the Germans too. He had an entire network built around smuggling them into Europe and selling them to the highest bidder. That's where his money came from. Every bit of it.
I can feel my fingers tighten on her wrist. I don't want to hurt her. I force myself not to hurt her. Did you know? I whisper.
No.
She shakes her head.
Not until last week. Not until we had to leave Paris.
Why are the Germans after him?
He took payment for a weapons shipment 2 weeks ago, but never delivered it to the Germans.
What happened to it?
He sold the shipment to some Frenchman in the Auvergne instead.
I force myself to loosen my grip on her hand. I release my fingers one by one and set my hand on the table beside hers. What Frenchman?
I don't know his name. Paul calls him a maquisard. Says he's gathering soldiers near Montmouchet to fight back against the Germans.
She shrugs, and when her shoulders drop, I can see every last scrap of hope she has left fall away. Her words tumble out uncontrollably.
Paul isn't a bad man, and I didn't know. He had a change of heart at the end. He didn't care about the money anymore, and he didn't want to help the Germans.
Too bloody late, I think. If I said the words aloud, they might kill her. If it were anyone else, I would delight in the assassination. I would enjoy watching them writhe. But I cannot do that to her, not to Stephanie. Keeping silent is the only mercy I can offer.
Stephanie, Paul says from the doorway 15 feet away. Time to go.
I cannot look at him again. I refuse. I look at my dearest friend instead.
You don't have to.
She grabs my hand and squeezes it hard. Silent tears run down her face. She shrugs again, but I'm not sure whom she's apologizing to.
I love him,
she says, then kisses me goodbye on the forehead. I don't look around until I hear the little bell chime above the cafe door. I catch a final glimpse of her bright blonde hair in the October sun. It glints in the light like a final wink, and then they are lost in the crowd. But I remain at that table in the corner, breath caught in my throat, because I am certain as I have been of anything in my life, that I will never see her again.